Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In the midst of the most nerve-wracking and unnerving election any of us in this country have ever experienced, how do we make sense of what's going on, what should be going on, and how not to go crazy keeping up with all the drama and suspense? Today, we talk with Kristen Eberhard, Climate and Democracy Director with Sightline Institute, who has been researching and writing exhaustively about every stage of the struggle to keep the 2020 election fair and democratic. We're recording on Thursday, November 5th, while the presidential election still hangs in the balance, as votes are being counted in several swing states. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this show, we'll know who our next president will be. Then again, maybe we won't. Kristen, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we are on day three of the never-ending election of 2020. We're recording this on Thursday, November 5th, and we're going to be airing it on the 9th. And who knows what's going to happen by then. So I'll start out by asking you, Kristen, do you think by the time people are listening to this show that we'll know who the president is going to be?
I think we will. I hope we will.
I want to talk a little bit about that process before we get into the areas that you've been writing more about in Sightline, about democracy and the whole way of strengthening our democracy through elections and voting. But I wonder what you feel about the process that we've been going through for the last few days. I just want to know, first of all, on a personal level, what are you going through?
Oh, well, I think like everybody, it's been a roller coaster. I've been pretending, trying to work, and then you're refreshing my browser and just watching the vote counts go up and stressing and trying not to stress. So I'm sure that a lot of people can relate to the tension.
Listeners can tell by the sound of my voice right now that I'm having a hard time physically, which I think that this thick voice is a result of too much stress and too much reading the news for the last 6 months and culminating with this crazy election. I'm curious, on Tuesday night, a lot of us were just visualizing the blue wave, which so many people have been talking about. And in fact, a friend of mine was telling me that for days she'd been imagining Biden and Harris with their arms raised, you know, winning resoundingly after taking Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina in the first hour of the election. That didn't happen. And I'm wondering, as somebody who's been following this process pretty closely, were you surprised that that didn't happen?
I have to admit, not terribly. You know, the thing that made us think there was going to be a blue wave is the polling. And I have to say that after 2016, I was just very skeptical of polling. And I did let myself get my hopes up a little bit, but I continued to be, just to take all the polling with a grain of salt. And it turns out the polling was also very off, again, despite, you know, them saying that they had, you know, made corrections and fixed things.
Well, interestingly, I don't think it's as off as it was in 2016.
It was better,
and
yeah.
A lot of people are giving Nate Silver a hard time, and Nate Silver has been saying for weeks that Trump had a path.
Yeah.
And he said 10% of a chance is not nothing, and you can win with 10%. And his analogy was, it's how often it rains in L.A. 10% chance of rain in L.A. So it does rain 36 days a year in L.A.
Yeah.
So I think that when you look at the things that we know about polling, I'm actually not that surprised by the results. What made me hopeful was the fact that the polls were way better this year for Biden than they had been for Clinton in 2016. So despite the fact that the polls didn't say what we hoped they were saying, how close do you think they actually came kind of relative to each other in showing us, giving a pretty accurate picture of what is happening, if you allow for polling error, as Nate Silver kept doing?
How close were the polls to the actual result? The tricky thing, of course, about polling an American election is that polls are more accurate at the national level. So we're seeing that Biden is, in fact, winning the will of the people. He's winning more votes. But that's not how you win the presidency. You win the presidency in Wisconsin and Florida and Georgia and North Carolina. And those places are really, really close. And I think the polling suggested maybe it was going to be not quite as tight as we've seen it be in Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada.
Yeah, Nevada surprised me a little bit because Nevada's been a blue state since Obama, I think. Are you aware of the organizing drives that have been going on in Nevada? I know that the Culinary Union is a very strong force in terms of politics there. So do you know if something shifted this year that kind of turned Nevada to be a little bit more purplish than it's been?
I don't know. I haven't been following Nevada that closely, maybe because the polling suggested. I was looking more closely at North Carolina and Pennsylvania.
What's interesting, actually, and this is something that we could sort of take a grain of optimism from, who would have thought that Georgia would be a swing state? Who would have thought that Arizona, which is looking like it's not even a swing state? I mean, Mark Kelly's triumph over McSally is quite dramatic. I think, last I saw, it was like at least a 5-point spread. So what does that show to you in terms of the widening of democracy in this country to see places that were such hardcore conservative bastions like Arizona and Georgia really shifting?
Yeah, I mean, that is maybe a hopeful thing. Both of those places saw really high turnout and saw a shift. I mean, on the other hand, you know, then there's Florida, which has historically been just a razor thin and was a pretty decisive win this year. So it's, you know, I it doesn't feel like things are moving all in one direction, right? So some things have moved one way and some things have moved the other. So Arizona moved towards looking like a pretty decisively blue state. But then again, Florida looked kind of decisive the other way.
I don't know. Actually, have you spent much time in Florida?
I have not, no.
Okay, I have. It doesn't surprise me at all. Florida is a really crazy place. And in fact, the part of Florida that I spent the most time in was Southwest Florida, Lee County, which is very, very conservative. Florida is, I think, a tinderbox of all the different forces at play politically and socially in this country. And one of the things that surprised me about how the Democrats were counting on Miami-Dade County and counting on the Latino vote. Well, the Latino vote in Miami is, they're Cubans. They're Cubans who, either the descendants or the ones who actually left after Fidel became president of Cuba, and is augmented by a lot of right-wing Venezuelans who've moved there in the last 15 years. That's not a base for the Democrats. It never has been.
I hope that that's a thing that the Democrats look at more closely, that to the extent they've been sort of thinking monolithically about the Latino vote or the person of color vote, that is, I mean, obviously it's not a monolith, but it does feel sometimes like the party treats it as such.
I've seen a couple of good headlines that say, not all Latinas are the same.
Yeah.
And I mean, and to me, it's such a real form of ignorance and racism, because in the Black community isn't monolithic either.
No.
But there's at least a lineage that is kind of uniform. Most Blacks came from, you know, descended from the same place, and most Blacks descended from slavery. But the Latinx community in the United States comes from many different countries, many different traditions.
Well, and even the Black community, you know, there are Black people who have been here for generations, but then there's people who have immigrated in the last generation or two, and that's a very different history and a very different, you know, culture and life path.
This Kamala Harris is an example of that.
Yeah.
We were talking about the things that give you hope as far as this election being a real showing of growing democracy. And I wonder, what do you see are the most hopeful signs coming out of this election?
Yeah, so the biggest one is just the voter turnout, that in the midst of a pandemic, so many states were able, you know, there were definitely hiccups, but many states were able to allow their voters to vote from home, that, you know, opened up early voting stations, and people turned out and voted. I mean, and of course, it was a high engagement, you know, high stakes election always drives more turnout, but it does seem like some of that turnout can be credited to elections officials making it easier to vote, which is a thing that we can carry forward into future elections, and just, you know, let's do that again. Let's make it easy for people to vote so that we can have more voices being heard in elections.
Well, this is also the first election where I've seen vote exclamation signs all over the place. I mean, on my phone, and I open the news feed, the first thing I have on it, and it's been like that for 3 months, is vote. You see it on ads in the newspaper, and it's not just Democrats trying to get out the vote. You get the feeling this is a nonpartisan move. What do you think has generated that, and how much do you think that has been affected by the pandemic?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a sense this year that Americans are worried about democracy. And I think, you know, maybe on both sides of the aisle, Trump's sort of attacks on democracy and on calling voting fraudulent and on, you know, right now asking for vote counting to stop, that I think a lot of Americans really know that that's an attack on our country and our country's history of being one of the longest running democracies in the world, and that their way for to counter that is to participate in democracy and go out and vote. And so I think that there's been just this huge energy of this is the thing that we can do as Americans and as citizens. Let's go and do it.
Well, I think one of the things that maybe surprised a lot of people on the progressive side is we thought that this big voter movement was going to be a progressive movement, and it would be, as people have been calling it, the big blue wave. What do you think it says that a lot of Trump supporters also came out to vote?
Yeah, you know, in some ways, I hope this is maybe a tiny silver lining. So it feels like running up to this election, the assumptions amongst Democrats were that more voters is good for Democrats. And that was the same assumption amongst Republicans, that more voters is going to be good for Democrats. And so they, at a policy level, you know, not at the voter level, but at the sort of policy operative level, Republicans have been responding to that by trying to stop people from voting. And Democratic lawmakers have been responding by trying to make it easier to vote. And that assumption maybe wasn't right. You know, a high turnout election actually turned out voters in both parties. Maybe, I hope, that will give those Republican operatives a little more comfort that they can support voting rights and not have it be bad for their party. And maybe it will open up an opportunity in the next couple of years to strengthen, to shore up voting rights where, it, you know, even in kind of red strongholds where the Republican lawmakers have been trying to tear them down for years.
Well, what's been interesting, and I think this is bearing out, that the same-day voting was, well, except for in the obvious blue states, leaned much more towards Trump, whereas the early voting and the vote by mail leaned towards Biden. So I wonder what that says to you.
Well, that says that Trump was out there telling his voters not to vote by mail and telling his voters that it was fraudulent. And they were taking their cues from the president, the head of their party, and choosing not to vote by mail. Whereas I feel like more progressive organizers and Democrats were out there telling people, hey, you can vote by mail, and in a pandemic, that might be the safest thing to do. And perhaps ironically, because so many Democrats voted early, the lines on Election Day were very reasonable. So the heavily Republican voters who turned out to vote on Election Day actually had a very kind of easy, smooth, pleasant experience.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're doing an election postmortem. Actually, we're right in the middle of the election, still postmorteming it, with Kristen Eberhard, who's the Climate and Democracy Director with Sightline Institute. One of the things about vote by mail that has been very interesting to watch is how quickly the election results were called in California, Washington, and Oregon compared to the rest of the country. It was like 8-0, less than one, and all of a sudden California, Oregon, and Washington in that order were declared for Biden. It reminds me also of 2008. Oregon was the state that put Obama over the top because we had our election results ready at 8:02. But meanwhile, we're still waiting for them to count votes in Nevada, in Arizona, Georgia. They're still counting votes all over the country, but in a really big way in the four or five states which are still undecided. What do you think the lessons can be learned in the states that are struggling right now to learn how to do vote by mail? What can they learn from those of us, particularly here in Oregon, where we've been voting by mail for 24 years, to make this process a lot more effective by the next election?
Ah, there are so many things that they can learn from us. We really know how to do it here with 2 decades of experience in Oregon. So I'd say the main thing for example, for Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, they don't start processing their ballots until Election Day, which is just crazy and unnecessary. So the processing of the ballots is different from the counting. When a vote-by-mail ballot comes in, it has a signature, and that's how you verify that it was the right voter. And so the first step to processing is just checking that signature against the signature on file, and then opening up the ballot, opening up the envelope, getting the ballot out, and getting it ready to push through the scanner. And there's no reason not to do all those steps before, and that's why Oregon, Washington, California, that's part of why they are able to be so quick, is they take care of all of that stuff. They check all the signatures, they cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And so then as soon as, you know, the day is ended, they, boom, put all of those through the scanner and tabulate them, and they have a count. In contrast, Pennsylvania, when the polls closed, then and only then were, you know, at 8 o'clock at night, were the poll workers then starting to look at every signature and compare it to the record and open up the ballots. So it's no surprise that they are still counting, and that is an easy fix. The legislature just has to say, yes, election officials, you can start processing these sooner. The election officials have been asking legislators for that, and the Republican-controlled legislature in Pennsylvania has refused to let them. But who knows? Maybe this year they'll say, you know what? We don't want to be the laggard who hasn't entered the 21st century of just, you know, letting you process ballots, and we're going to fix that this year. Maybe we'll see that.
Well, I had a friend who was doing calling. She was calling people around the country back in the spring to encourage them to vote by mail. And she was calling them as an Oregonian to tell them this really works, and sharing with them her experiences of transitioning from being somebody who had voted at the polling place most of her life to back in 1996 when she started have to vote by mail because that's what it was the only way to vote in Oregon after that. I wonder if there's ways that we can continue to do that, because that seemed to be one of the concerns, was a lot of people didn't trust the vote by mail process. So I just wonder if we can be ambassadors of vote by mail in Oregon, and there's ways that we could actually structurally help other people in the country to understand how it works, and it would be both our election officials who would be training other election officials in other states, but also our citizens in Oregon, helping train citizens in other parts of the country that this is a really good process.
Yeah. Well, I will say, though, that some people in some places do have reason not to trust the system as much as we do because their system is not as good. So, for example, in North Carolina, they are required not just to sign the ballot themselves, but also to get a witness to sign it. And then that witness has to print their name and write their address. And if they forget to do any of those things, their ballot gets thrown out. And so, and the net result is that North Carolina has been throwing out about twice as many black voters' ballots as white voters. And so, so black voters in North Carolina have some reason not to trust the system. But again, it's such an easy fix. Just don't require a witness. Why are you requiring it? It doesn't help make the process any more secure. It just stops some people from voting.
Well, in fact, weren't there lawsuits trying to stop that process? And they were, and it was actually fought by Republicans?
Yes. So there were a bunch of lawsuits. So North Carolina actually normally requires two witnesses. They brought it down to one this year since they were expecting such a volume of vote by mail. So that's an improvement, but it's still not great. And then the other thing that North Carolina election officials did is they previously didn't have a requirement to notify voters if their vote by mail ballot was rejected and give them a chance to fix it. So this year they created a process for people to be able to, you know, if they forgot to write down their witness's address, they could just fix that and still have their vote counted. And the Republican National Committee sued the state over that and said, trying to get them to not allow voters to fix any problems with their ballot, to just throw all those ballots out if the voter made any kind of mistake on the envelope. That lawsuit was mostly unsuccessful, which is good because thousands and thousands of North Carolina voters are using the process to fix and make sure that their vote gets counted. And the election is so close in North Carolina, those thousands could really make a difference.
Well, I recall it was a few years ago, maybe the last time Obama ran, or it might have been 4 years ago, where I was informed when I voted that I could sign up to have the election board email me when my ballot was received and then when it was processed. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing that ever since. And I didn't realize what a novel thing this was until I was talking to my dentist last week. And she was telling me how she knew that her ballot had gotten in and it was accepted because she had signed up for a text. And she was really excited to know this. And I was thinking, well, this should be more widely known. I'm not sure at this point in Oregon if you automatically get signed up for that, or if you still have to go online and sign up.
So this is actually one area where Oregon and Washington are not leaders on vote by mail. Five states have a statewide tracking and they automatically enroll their voters in it. Oregon and Washington don't have statewide tracking. Only certain counties do. So I live in Multnomah County and I can track my ballot, but other counties in Oregon, you can't. Same thing, King County, you can track it in Washington, but not every county in Washington. And you have to sign up. So I signed up. I love getting my text message saying your ballot's on the way, your ballot arrived, your ballot's being counted. But not all voters realize that that's even an option. And then it's not an option in all counties in Oregon and Washington.
Well, that seems like that's one of the movements that we should be making. Absolutely. In Oregon and Washington.
And it's so cost effective. It's one of the cheapest, you know, some things around vote by mail, like paying for postage ends up, you know, costing some money to the government. But ballot tracking, it's very cost effective. And it's such a boost for voters to absolutely know my vote got in and it got counted.
I was just thinking how everything was on such tenterhooks this election. My wife got her announcement on a Friday. We voted on Thursday. She didn't get the one that said it's been received. She just got the one that was saying it was accepted. And I got the one that was received, but I didn't get the one that was accepted. And all weekend, she was worrying that my ballot hadn't been accepted. Then Monday morning, I got the email. And I think about how everything has been so heightened for this election, and it's made us so much more nervous. I wonder how this nervousness that we've been feeling about everything, like getting our votes, our ballots tracked, how this can translate into action for the next election to make sure that everybody is taken better care of, their votes are more are guaranteed to arrive in the right place and to be accepted.
Yeah, I hope that there will be a movement in some states to pass sort of comprehensive voting right, or, you know, just voter protection, just voter administration bills, and just take what we're doing in Oregon and Washington. You know, they don't have to recreate the wheel. We already know how to do it. So vote, making voting by mail easier, making sure that you're tracking the ballots, making sure that you're processing them and counting them in a timely manner are important. And then there's also just really basic things that we're doing here, like automatic voter registration, so that your voter rolls are up to date. And then there's something called the Electronic Registration Information Center. It's a multi-state organization that compares voter registrations across county lines and across state lines to make sure that there's no duplicates, and that if somebody has moved from one county to the other, that their new address is in the system. And it also identifies people who haven't registered yet so that local officials can reach out to them and help them register. Anyway, those three things together, just putting everybody on the rolls, making sure the rolls are up to date, and then sending everybody a ballot so that they can vote. Those are what have pushed, you know, Oregon and Washington often have record turnout, you know, on par or higher than swing states, even though we're safe states that usually have lower turnout. And just imagine if we pushed just those three reforms, they're pretty simple, they're pretty cost effective, across every state. All of a sudden, voting would just be easier. It just feel more like, yeah, I'm an American and I go out and vote, rather than it being this minefield that we feel like we're navigating right now.
A lot of people, particularly in other countries, have criticized the United States for, first of all, having Election Day on Tuesday, it not being a holiday, and it be only one day. Now, that has definitely changed this year, but it was seen as a very undemocratic thing, and it was one of the problems I think people feel has actually suppressed the vote. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, and how this year people have been talking, instead about having Election Day, we've had election season, how that really can increase voting.
Absolutely. Having voting happen on one Tuesday in November that people don't have off work is incredibly anti-voter. And, you know, people sometimes bemoan that Americans aren't sufficiently engaged, you know, they're apathetic, they don't turn out, especially young people. But when you actually ask people, and in particular young people, why they didn't vote, it's because they can't get off work on a Tuesday, they can't get to the polling place, they don't. It's all these barriers that we throw in front of them by having this very strange system of having it be on a Tuesday that's not off work. So we can fix a lot of that by what we had this year with this more election season, that a lot of states had 2 or 3 weeks of early voting, so you could just go on whichever day worked for you, or voting from home, which, even better, you can sit at your kitchen table and really think about your choices and then just turn it in whenever it's convenient on your way somewhere else.
Well, I'm thinking of an advantage and a disadvantage of early voting, and One of the things that I was aware of this year was much less of a worry about the October surprise, though Trump kept trying to throw them at us and they were so stupid that they'd never stick. But when people start voting in early October, the impact of something like Hillary Clinton's emails is not going to have the same kind of impact it would have if we didn't have early voting. Now, on the other hand, and I'm thinking about our mayoral race here in Portland, I had lots of discussions with people about who to vote for, and I think a lot of people felt like it was not a real happy choice, that neither candidate was really what we felt like the city needed. But I was leaning towards not the mayor, and I was trying to convince some friends about that, and people had some good arguments for, you know, still voting for him. At the end, though, when he decided to push back the budget debate until this week, which angered a lot of people, and it particularly angered Joanne Hardesty, who then sent out an email endorsing Sarah Iannarone. And I talked to a lot of people who said if she had done that a little earlier, they would have voted for Sarah Iannarone. So it's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I did an interview with John Kitzhopper years ago, it was about vote by mail, back when I think Oregon was the only state that was doing it at that point. And he mentioned that as a problem, that when you have early voting, things can develop late on in the campaign that would maybe change people's vote, but it's too late. So I wonder how you weigh those.
Mm, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in Oregon, the vote by mail window is 3 weeks. And so I think the convenience of being able to make sure, you know, like we have 80% voter turnout in Oregon, and knowing that you can sort of, and also, you know, we have a lot of things on the ballot here in Oregon. I'm not sure if all places have so much, but we often have a lot of local, regional, statewide measures in addition to all of the candidates on the ballot. And for me, it takes me some time to read through them and figure it out and figure out like what would it really do and who's endorsing it. So when I weigh kind of more people voting and having the time to really be thoughtful about what they're voting for versus the occasional late breaking event that, you know, completely upends your assumptions, I definitely lean in favor of just making it easier for voters.
Well, you mentioned that whole thing about sitting around your kitchen table, perhaps with friends, perhaps by yourself, and reading through the ballot pamphlet, which actually I understand is rather unique in Oregon, that a lot of states don't have ballot pamphlets like we have. And so you can read through and really, at least for me, one of the things, as you mentioned, the big thing that's decisive for me is who's endorsed this ballot measure, who's endorsed this candidate that I've never heard of. So that seems like you can do a lot more research and become a much more informed voter. Of course, you have to get breakthrough for people who don't like to read.
Yeah.
I wonder if we should have a cartoon voter pamphlet for people who don't.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, I love the Citizen Initiative Review. You know, they only do one every other year, but they always have a very short, pithy, very reasonable, considered, because it came from 24 regular people, and their description is often very powerful for voters. I also love, like this year, one of my sons is in fourth grade, and they had a democracy sort of, they did a faux election in their class, and so he, for the first time, was really, when I was sitting there with my ballot, you know, he was like, oh, what's this? And what are you doing? And I got to talk to him a little bit about the things on the ballot and how I was thinking about it. So he's getting a early introduction to thinking about being a voter, which he wouldn't get if I just like left and went to the polling place and came home.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're doing an election postmortem with Kristen Eberhard, who's the Climate and Democracy Director with Sightline Institute. I want to move now to how the election, as is the ongoing election here in the United States, is being perceived around the world and what it says about the state of democracy in this country. One quote that really got me was in Der Spiegel, which is Germany's leftist news weekly. They compared Trump to a late Roman emperor who has set a historic standard for voter contempt. And there's a lot of other concerns around the world of the fact that the United States is falling apart in the face of a global pandemic and not being able to deal with that and having this election that's being contested by the president and all his machinations. So what is your sense about what this says about the United States to the rest of the world?
I have actually been encouraged by the way the media has handled the election, because I, like many others, had a lot of fears beforehand that, Trump was going to make some authoritarian moves and not count all the votes, or try and declare victory prematurely, or try and, I mean, he's still trying to get some votes thrown out. But I actually, right now, as of November 5th, am feeling like a little more encouraged that our democracy, while lots of room for improvement and lots of things that we really need to shore up after this year, it's holding up. And in particular, the media, by not paying attention to Trump's calling it for himself when he was still way behind, have sort of shut down, at least for the moment, some of those more threatening authoritarian impulses. That said, it is still concerning that in what, we pride ourselves on being a world-class democracy, and yet there are just so many cracks in our system, from the most basic things of making sure everybody can vote, as we just talked about, when you have vote be a work day, that makes it really hard. That certain states have ID laws where 10% of their eligible voters don't have that ID, even though they should be able to vote. The law makes it so that they can't. That is a crazy anti-democratic, not respectful of voters. So we have a lot of, and then there's also just, then you get into like the basic structure of our system, that we have a Senate that represents states and not people, that we have an electoral college that represents states and not people. Those are just anti-democratic systems that are built into the structure of our federal government. So there's good reasons for other countries to be looking at us askance, but I actually am feeling better now than I did a month ago.
That's good to hear. One of the things that I wonder about and sometimes worry about is, we've been talking about the problems about the Electoral College since 2000, when it was really clear that it was very undemocratic, and that, in fact, that the presidential election hinged not just on the unhinged state of Florida, which probably Gore had won Florida, but through the machinations of a very right-wing government, particularly the Secretary of State, and then finally winding up in the Supreme Court, which it should never have gone to, that the election was given to George W. Bush. So since then, people have been talking very agitatedly about getting rid of the Electoral College. After 2016, when Hillary Clinton won by over 2 million votes, which was four times as much as Gore had gotten over George W. Bush, it became even more apparent that the Electoral College is just inherently unfair. And there are movements like the National Popular Vote movement to get movement towards getting rid of the Electoral College. But why is it so hard to get rid of it?
So I think that the movement in the early 2000s was somewhat bipartisan. At least in 2012, a lot of Republicans were worried that Romney was going to win the popular vote and not the Electoral College, which made them more open to the idea that the will of the people should prevail and not just a slanted selection of states. But unfortunately, with 2000 and then 2016, and now in 2020, even if Biden wins, Trump will have gotten much closer to winning the Electoral College than to winning the popular vote. That has, I think, convinced a lot of Republicans that they need the Electoral College in order to win the presidency, which makes them not supportive of having everybody's vote count equally. That said, that's again kind of at the politician level, but I think at the voter level, polls consistently show that voters of both parties think that every voter should count. They think it's crazy that every voter doesn't count equally and are very supportive of a national popular vote. So it's possible that the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact could make gains even in red states through ballot initiatives, though they haven't been able to pass through the Republican-controlled state legislatures.
Now, has that passed in Oregon yet?
Yes, Oregon passed it last year.
So how many states have passed that compact?
So there's 16, 15 plus DC.
And what would it take for it to actually have any teeth?
So it has to get, so right now it has 196 electoral votes are signed on. That needs to get to 270 to take effect.
And so once it does that, then what would happen?
So it's an agreement amongst states where states that signed on said that once states equal to 270 electoral votes sign on, everyone who's signed on will give all of their electoral votes to the person who won the most votes overall. So it just automatically, so that means that we'll have to wait until every vote is counted to make sure that we know who won more votes. And then once that happens, all of the states signed on to the compact will give their votes to that winner. And so once that happens, it really would change the way that the campaigns go. You know, so right now we know that Hillary Clinton won more votes. We know that Joe Biden is winning more votes. But that they were campaigning in an electoral college world. What it would look like once people are campaigning in an every vote counts world, it'll be very different. You know, right now they're spending almost all of their campaign visits in Florida, Pennsylvania. If every vote counted equally, they'd have to go everywhere in the country. They'd have to speak to everyone equally.
Now, I read one time that the whole rationale for the Electoral College was to give equal power to small states because they would be overlooked. Like, who'd want to go campaign in Wyoming when you can go campaign in California? But then I also learned that it had a lot to do with the South. I think it was instituted actually before the Civil War. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it was one of the trade-offs in order to get the South to even agree to so much of, I guess, the Constitution was that they would have this electoral college, which gave the South a lot more power because the South had less population than the North. And in fact, it was a way to keep down black people. So I think it's interesting that there was this myth that the Electoral College was there to give a fair vote to every voter in small states versus large states, and that in fact, no, it has really some very racist origins.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about all of the defenses of the Electoral College, if you were just to be an alien or somebody from a different country and come and look at the Electoral College, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you do it this way? And so all the defenses are sort of just trying to come up with reasons to defend a thing that on its face doesn't make sense. And a lot of the excuses sort of going back to the founding, the funny thing is the founders, it really wasn't that well thought through. They basically, some founders wanted a popular vote and some wanted a parliamentary system, you know, where the Congress chooses its leader, and they just couldn't agree. And so the Electoral College was sort of this slapdash last minute, they literally threw it together in the last few days of the convention, compromise that, as you said, it incorporated the compromise to get the 35th compromise, which gave the South outsized voting power without letting their enslaved black people actually vote. And then by making the Electoral College be sort of this agglomeration of the House, which was now had this racist component to it, and then the Senate, which had the racist component of giving every state equal votes, even if they didn't have equal people. You put those together and you get a vote for the president, which heavily favored the South. And indeed, it worked for many years. Our first 10, I think, presidents were all from Southern states.
In the beginning, was the president actually elected directly by the voters, or was the president elected by state houses?
Never. It was always the Electoral College. It's just that states have kind of changed over the years how they do their Electoral College votes. So initially, most states did what Maine does. They gave some votes to one and some to the other, depending on how much support they had at the time. But over time, states realized that they could have more power by giving all of their votes to one candidate. And so slowly, as states realized that they were kind of getting left behind by not really throwing all of their weight behind one candidate, they all fell. And now what we see is almost all states do this, what I call the state winner-take-all method, where they, even if one candidate won, you know, 50.1%, they get 100% of that state's electoral college votes.
Well, what does Maine do? Because I've been trying to figure that out for the last 2 days. I know that Maine gave 3 votes to Biden and 1 vote to Trump.
So Maine has 2 congressional districts, and they give 1 vote to each of the winners of those congressional districts, and then the other two votes they give to the statewide winner.
Now, how would that differ from having it be just a national popular vote?
So in a national popular vote, I think Maine is one of the ones that is signed on. Let's assume that in the final count, Biden wins the most votes. Maine would give all of their votes to Biden.
Well, one other thing I'd like to talk about with Maine is the whole idea of ranked voting, which is one reason why it's taking them so long to come up with it. I mean, I don't know how many people live in Maine. It's a pretty small state. They weren't declared for Biden until yesterday. So why does it take Maine so long to count their votes?
Some places count by county and some places count by precinct. And Maine counts by precinct, so even though they don't have very many people, they have a lot of different people counting. They also don't have many scanners, partly because they have such small precincts. So in Oregon, we have these high-speed scanners. You know, when you get your ballot, you just put a stack on, feed it through, it counts them in a few seconds. Maine, they have some lower-speed scanners, and then they're also counting by hand.
But isn't it also, don't they use ranked voting in Maine?
They do, but that actually hasn't come into play in either the presidential or their congressional races. So in 2018, they had a congressional race where nobody won a majority in the first round. And so they eliminated the candidates who had only gotten a couple percentages of the vote and redistributed those votes until somebody won a majority. So that did take longer because they had to do that second round of counting. But as far as I know, they haven't had to do any second round because they've had all majority winners on the first round.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about ranked voting, but first I need to let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're doing an election postmortem with Kristen Eberhard, who's the Climate and Democracy Director with Sightline Institute. Well, let's talk a bit more about what ranked voting actually is. I know that you wrote an article about that this morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A number of years ago, I was at some conference and hanging out with some people from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it was the end of the election week, and they were still waiting to find out their results from their city elections in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the person who was waiting was explaining to me that they had ranked voting and it took a long time. I think they called it a different proportional
representation.
Right. So let's talk about these different methods of finding ways to have something other than just kind of a winner-take-all approach to voting.
Yeah. So Cambridge is a great example. So they use multi-winner ranked choice voting. It's a form of proportional representation to elect their city council and their school board. And so what that means is that they have, the way that they do it is they have a nine-member city council. And so all of the council members just run together in one big pot, instead of being able to sort of choose your race as we can here in Portland, where you're also then kind of choosing your opponent. And so it's a very strategic consideration in Portland, like which seat to run for. In Cambridge, it's just everyone's running for city council. And then the voters rank their choices, and then the top nine winners get the seats. And it changes the whole dynamic of the race, and then it also changes who can run and who can win. Basically, people who represent kind of a smaller interest group in the city can win a seat on the council. Whereas here in Portland, everyone is a winner-take-all seat, and so essentially 50% of the voters in Portland can elect 100% of the council seats. And so anybody who's in the minority in any way doesn't get any voice on council. But in Cambridge, if you have, 10-15% of the voters who are Green Party or 20% who are socialists or whatever, they can then get one of those nine seats.
Now, do you feel like that's more democratic than the current system and like what we have in Portland?
It is. It's definitely more democratic because it sort of the way the math works out is here in Portland, you can have maybe 49% of voters who went out and voted, we're not even talking about voter turnout, just like people who voted, who don't see anybody representing their interests on city council. The way that Cambridge does it, that number is more like 10%. So that means that 90% of voters, if you go out and vote, you are going to get somebody who represents you on the city council. In Portland, 49%, you might get nothing. So that's much more democratic, and it's much more, it instills a lot more trust in voters that they know if I take the trouble to go out and vote, it's going to make a difference in the election. And then it makes a big difference also just in the way that the council operates, that they have this bigger, you know, they can't ignore half of the city because somebody is going to be there speaking up for those people on the council. It also really changes the two-party dynamics. And I know, you know, Portland's local races are nonpartisan, and a lot of places have nonpartisan local races, but like at the state and federal levels, we are now just so entrenched in these camps. You know, you're in the red camp or the blue camp, and proportional representation lets you break out of that a little bit. And maybe, you know, you're you like an independent candidate or a libertarian candidate or a Green Party candidate, you can vote for them and have them win and have it not be a catastrophe for your, you know, if you lean left, have it not be a catastrophe for the Democrats.
Well, it seems that with ranked voting, it's a little bit different because you're still having a winner take all.
Yes.
But what is the difference?
Yeah. So single winner ranked choice voting is when you're still just electing one person. You're just electing, you know, one governor or one representative, but you just get to rank your choices. Multi-winner ranked choice voting is when you have more seats in the race at the same time. And it's multi-winner ranked choice voting that really lets you kind of break out of the two-party system. Single winner ranked choice voting doesn't necessarily break you out of the two-party system, but it does make the campaigns much less negative and divisive. And the reason is that even if you can't get somebody's first choice vote, you might still get their second, and that could still make a difference to you winning. So you, as a candidate, you don't want to just say, oh, well, you know, I don't care about you and your interests anymore because I already know you're voting for somebody else. So you're like, you're dead to me. You still are trying to reach out to that voter and figure out what they want and what they have in common with you and where you can meet them and talk to them in hopes that they might still rank you second.
Well, and also it makes me wonder, we're in the mayoral race this year in Portland. There were two candidates and then there was a write-in. And they just referred to it as write-in. It was a Teresa Rayford. And I was wondering if we'd had ranked voting, and with that is a possibility that there would have been a different outcome for the election.
I think it is very likely we would have had a different outcome. So very likely that the Teresa Rayfield voters would have ranked her first and Sarah Iannarone second. You know, I can't say that for sure, but just knowing who they are and what they stand for, that seems the most likely outcome. And if that had happened, if all of those Teresa Rayford voters had had that option of ranking Sarah second, probably Sarah would have won. And instead, we had, you know, 42% and then 13% for Teresa Rayfield, and Ted Wheeler is the mayor.
And he didn't even get 50.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It would have completely... And it would have also changed the dynamic of the race, that as it was, Teresa Rayford supporters were sort of like, don't vote for Sarah, you know, vote for Teresa. She's the more whatever. They wouldn't have had to be so singular. They could have said, look, Sarah's fine, but make sure you rank her second, sure, but rank Teresa first. And that they could have, you know, talked about what they had in common with Sarah or the ways where she was good, instead of trying to just know Teresa's the only one that you should vote for.
The last part of the show, I want to talk about the impending civil war. One of the things that was the most dispiriting for me the last couple of days is really understanding just how divided this country is. And it feels like it's pretty even division. So I'm wondering what your sense about that is and how we go forward.
Yeah, this is a real, real challenge for our country. And what I saw in the election results was just a real doubling down on the urban-rural divide that we've been seeing opening up for many years, but it just, you know, even more so this year, where you have these urban areas that are tend to be the economic engines, tend to be the places where younger people are moving, more educated people are moving, tend to be more open to sort of changing cultural values, you know, different cultures. And then you have the rural areas, which, many of which are struggling economically and are struggling with the changing face of the country. And they have really, those two places and peoples seem to have really settled into these rigid teams. And in part because they are geographically, like physically distanced. So whereas in previous incarnations of the two parties, you still maybe would have a neighbor who was a different party than you. You might still have somebody who went to your church with a different party, and so you'd have some exposure to them and to see them as a person and to see that they're still a good person, they just have a different value than you. But because we're now like physically separated, like you don't have a neighbor, you know, if you live in an urban area, you probably don't have a neighbor who's a Trump supporter. If you live in a rural area, you probably don't see a neighbor with a Biden yard sign. It becomes kind of easier to just see the other as, you know, like what's wrong with you. And my one piece of hope on this, maybe this is naive, is that it seems like President Trump has really pushed those dividing lines. He has not had any rhetoric around unification, around we're all Americans, around the ways in which we're all humans and depend on each other. It's all been like this, those other people are bad. And I think that's really just fed into what's already kind of a difficult, sorted situation. And I hope that maybe with the person with the biggest megaphone in the country talking, knock on wood, right? We still don't know. But hope, if that were to happen, that the president is not exacerbating our existing divisions, maybe there's more opportunity to start finding some common ground again. But it's tough because there are kind of two different worldviews that are coexisting in one big country.
Now, one of the things that a lot of us were really worrying about was a lot of violence in the streets as a result. There was a little bit of semi-violence in Portland last night, and there was also a larger peaceful rally, march and rally, that was led by Black people. I don't know who led the violent window-breaking one. I'm assuming it was probably not Black people. I just wonder what your sense of is what the next few days are going to be like and how we stave off the sense that we are at the brink of civil war.
The more that the counting is allowed to go on and that, you know, people have the sense that this is a legitimate election, I think that goes a long way to helping people feel like they don't have to go out and violently protest because the system is working. But on the other hand, there's a lot of Trump supporters who, you know, he has primed that this election was going to be stolen, it was going to be fraudulent, and it was going to be all those things. And so, and you've already seen them, you know, banging on the windows of the election offices in Michigan, telling them to stop the count. So I worry that depending on how things go and how close the count is and how much Trump continues to double down on that sort of language and message, that we could see some escalations amongst his supporters if they feel that the system was not working and that the election was stolen.
One thing that gives me hope is I was watching on the news last night, the election people in Michigan and in Wisconsin, basically talking about how they have it under control. I think they learned a lot from Florida in 2000. Is that a sense that you have? And the lessons, what do you think the lessons from 2000 are that the electoral people in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania can hang on to keep the vote counting going?
Yeah, I think those election officials, I think they are doing their best to kind of, you know, just do their jobs. But I think it's really, there's been a lot of good just messaging. And like you said, that you've seen the sort of the vote signs out everywhere. I think there's been a lot of count every vote messaging from advocates and political leaders and celebrities. And it's a very simple message. It's very easy to understand. We live in a democracy. We count every vote. And it's actually much harder to say why we should not count every vote. That's a tricky message to put out in a democracy. So I think I feel a little encouraged that messaging seems to be working. We live in a democracy. We don't just stop counting because somebody feels like it.
Well, Kristen, it's really great to talk to you. I appreciate your helping calm me down during this rather jagged time.
Yeah. And hopefully the next few days will continue to be calming and not escalating.
Well, thanks a whole lot for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Kristen Eberhard, Climate and Democracy Director with Sightline Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to KBOO-FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you already are a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with a wish by Hamza Eldin. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.